Yahoo! 5 p.m. Friday. We made it. Congratulations, everybody. It's time to celebrate. Time for the happiest of happy hours.
I no believe it.
It is, of course, the voice of Nassau Community College, 90.3 WHPC. Time for American Hit Radio. I'm your host, Tom Ryan, my lovely wife and co-host and engineer extraordinaire, Heidi Morales Ryan, here as well, as we launch into the beginnings of another How Music Changed series. We just started 2 weeks ago covering the music of the Kinks, a band that was so slow to be recognized as being an important part of the British invasion, and eventually came to be pretty much one of the most, I think they were probably one of the most beloved bands around right now from that era.
People, a lot of people had to play catch up on them, I think, but
No doubt. I sort of did as well, but this shows we're doing our best to do exactly that for you, dear listener, our wonderful audience. And I will admit, I realize that in our series for the Kinks, so far it's gotten off to a relatively slow start. We did two shows already, with going very deep into their past history, their very early years. Now, that's mainly due to the fact that both Ray and Dave Davies, the two brothers who make up the core of the band, have extensive autobiographies that cover their early years in amazing detail. Excuse me, I'm reading them both, and I'm excerpting them considerably. I mean, I'm probably really covering something about, like, you know, it's hard to say what percentage really, but I'd say approximately 10% of what I'm actually reading in, you know, from the whole book I'm excerpting to read on the air. But, you know, obviously it makes for a few great stories, but, you know, fans of the band might wonder, how could we cover 2 hours of the band's history and we haven't even played a single hit yet? Well, that's true. What we have been doing is we've been playing excerpts from their very early releases to more or less cover a sense of growth as we move through the early years. Well, this episode, which is episode 3, it rectifies that. We still have a lot of backstories, this time told virtually exclusively. I think I'm going to let Ray Davies do pretty much all the talking in this one. Ray is more verbose than his brother, and I think that his book is going to be covering less of the full story. I think Ray's book will end where Dave Davies' book keeps going as we go through it. So Ray will provide us with his own entertaining tales that convey the circuitous path that the band had to take to arrive at their first major success. Now, on the outside, if I wasn't going to be doing all of this, you know, coverage, and I was just going to think about the Kinks, it would be really easy to imagine that they suddenly just appeared on the scene because, oh, the British rock and roll thing was happening. They had a hit song. They had a hit song in their pocket. They, you know, went down to a record, you know, company. They got signed, and boom, they had a big hit. Well, obviously, these shows do, I hope, an adequate job of conveying that things are never quite that as easy as they seem. So let's pick up then where we left off last week. And as I said, the band was just coming together. As I had already indicated, I'm going to let Ray do the talking from his book called X-Ray, his quote-unquote unauthorized autobiography. As Mick Avery had not joined at this point, it was decided that we would use a session drummer for our recording called Bobby Graham. I had heard his playing on other records and was bowled over by his style and power, which was very reminiscent of Dave Clark's drumming on all of his hits. Graham added a tidiness and a dimension to our sound, which had usually been dependent on the distorted fuzziness of Dave and me playing too loud through amplifiers that were not equipped for the volume. As we were tuning up in the studio, Dave played a chord which started to feed back through the amplifier. This caused the chord to oscillate between the pickup on his guitar and the Vox 30 amp that Dave was plugged into. On top of the Vox was the little green amp that Dave had started using to get that fuzziness into his sound. The engineer, who was placing a microphone in front of Dave's speaker, jumped backwards. Dave smiled and played an even louder chord.
Nice.
This time, instead of a low melodic whine, the feedback had a piercing whistle that made the engineer put his hands over his ears. Dave held the screeching guitar aloft to maximize the feedback. The engineer screamed and ran out of the building into the street, and as far as we know, he never returned. Eventually, Dave was persuaded to turn down his amp, and we got on with the recording. The instrumental backtracks were recorded first, and then it was time to put on the vocals. When we played back the songs at the end of the session, Dave and I were both amazed at how Shel Talmy had managed to smooth out all of the rough edges in the track and made the song sound very polished and professional. I was astonished at how good we sounded, even though it didn't sound like us at all. Long Tall Sally was to be our first single, with I Took My Baby Home on the B-side. Both of those tracks, that's how we ended our show last week, our second show. Pi Records had offered us a contract to release three singles as an option in their favor to renew. Robert and Granville took a percentage as Bosco Bell Productions and passed on a payment to Larry's company. Shel Talmy was to produce the singles. Arthur Howes was set as our agent. All we needed now was the record to be a hit, and we would all be destined for success. Long Tall Sally was to be released in a few weeks, and we still needed a name for the group. Well, we had been playing the Deb Dances with Robert. We had been called the Boll Weevils, a song by Bo Diddley. I always thought this sounded a little too twee. Later, we called ourselves the Ravens, but Robert thought that this sounded too suburban. One evening, we were having a drink in a pub with Larry Page, and somebody commented on the fake leather capes that Dave and Pete were wearing. Someone else said that we were wearing kinky boots, similar to those worn by Honor Blackman in The Avengers. Larry overheard someone call us kinks and concluded that because of the kinky clothes we wore and the fact that the new drummer looked a little like a police identikit version of a pervert, we might as well call ourselves the Kinks.
That's funny.
We looked at one another in an unimpressed sort of way, said no more, finished our drinks and left. A few days later, Larry showed us the mock-up of the artwork for the advertisement for the single, and there we were, the Kinks. I hated it. But Larry's eyes were glowing with excitement. Kinks, it's short, five letters. You'll be bottom of the bill, so you'll need something that will stand out. But will people think that we're all weird? Well, that might not be such a bad thing. I can see it. The curiosity value will be incredible. That's the gimmick. You all dress in leather with whips and riding boots. Very kinky. Larry was walking around the room in full flow. David and Pete were excited, but not taking the whole thing seriously. Larry continued enthusiastically. Then we'll have some shots done of you wearing the leather gear, whips and leather. We'll put the pictures in the trades. They'll love it. But you've got to get the new stage gear made. Lots of buckles and leather straps.
Oh, boy.
I went along with it. I knew that we could change the name when the record flopped, so I didn't care. Larry was the only member of our management team with showbiz experience, so it was considered that he knew best. I hated the name, but what did I know? I hated my own name even more, but I had been walking around with that all my life, so who was I to complain? Several weeks later, we, the Kinks, found ourselves in John Stevens' boutique in Carnaby Street having the final fitting for our new stage gear. A mixture of Thames Green skin-tight Robin Hood with Avengers-style leather trimmings. An amalgam of period B movie costumes and S&M. Like our first record, the gear was devised on a whim and hastily thrown together in order to cash in on a fad and meet a deadline. The only difference was that our record at least sounded finished, whereas our clothes looked as though the tailor had forgotten to sew the material together before delivering. Then there was the problem of my teeth. To be precise, the gap between my two front teeth, which appeared in photographs as a black space wherever I smiled. This particularly worried Larry, who, as a singer himself in the early days of pop music and skiffle, knew that singers had to have flawless looks, clear complexions, and most of all, rows of bright white sparkling teeth. I was the lead singer on the single, and I had all three faults. Two could be overcome by large quantities of makeup, but the last and fatal flaw, namely the gap between my two front teeth, could not be easily overcome. At least Larry was to the point. They'll never let you on the box with railings like that. I fixed you up with an appointment with the dentist. He'll sort you out. I sat quietly while the dentist looked at my teeth with disapproval. Then he became confident. We've sorted out many big stars with worse problems than this. This will take no time at all. I felt immediately reassured, and not such a freak after all. Then I heard the sound of a drill being started. It was a sound that brought back memories of my endless visits to the dentist as a child. It was all too obvious that this was not going to be as simple or temporary as I had been led to believe. When I asked what was going to be done, the dentist casually explained that he was going to cut away my existing two front teeth and replace them with caps.
Oh, my.
He assured me that it would be permanent and make me look more acceptable. I immediately jumped out of the chair. After frantic telephone calls to Larry and Granville, we agreed to compromise and put temporary caps over my existing teeth for the television show. If I was comfortable with them, the dentist would do a more permanent job at a later date. And so, I made my first appearance on Ready, Steady, Go with the largest front teeth since Bugs Bunny. A cameraman was heard to say to his director, "You want the singer in close-up. You mean the one with the goofy teeth?"
Nice.
We did our spot on Ready, Steady, Go. After the song, the interviewer, Michael Aldridge, spoke to Dave and made some remark comparing us with the Rolling Stones. Dave gave a full reply full of innocent wit and a delightful smile at the camera, and it was all over. My only contribution, apart from miming the song, was to stand bolt upright in the background and smile my new smile as Dave did the interview.
Nice.
Let's play an early track that they had recorded around. This time, this is called You Do Something to Me. Sounding very much like an English-British invasion band, but still trying to find the sound that is uniquely theirs. Now back to Ray's account of things. Although I was the lead singer of the group, it was Dave, with his long flowing hair, and Pete with his gift of the gab, who really grabbed center stage after the show. Outside the studios, my niece Jackie and some of her friends, who had already formed a fan club, were waiting to mob us as we emerged. Robert and Grenville had also arranged a photographer to be on hand to take pictures of the event. We were surprised to see that a picture appeared in the New Musical Express the following week. The television exposure gave the single a tremendous boost, and it entered the Melody Maker chart the following week at number 42. Someone in the family had taken a picture of us as we were miming the song on television. Pete Quaife insisted on wearing his stage gear for days afterwards, even though it was impractical for normal everyday activities, such as sitting down. The following week, the record had dropped away out of sight, and there was even a rumor that somebody had bought the record into the chart for that single week. If such rumors were true, we were in no mood to believe them. As far as we were concerned, the name The Kinks was on the map, and we had, albeit in a modest way, made our first little dent in the world of pop music. The first ever official Kinks gig took place at the Town Hall, Oxford, on a cold night in February 1964. The opening act was an R&B group from London called the Downliner Sect. Both groups were playing Bo Diddley songs, and so it was a night notable for the sound of maracas, which echoed around the half-empty hall. This gave the impression that somebody was shaking a giant pepper pot. A series of gigs followed, and we started traveling to small clubs up and down the country. The Kinks were billed as having appeared on Ready, Steady, Go, and would sing their chart-smashing hit, Long Tall Sally. Just after we had taken Mick Avery on as drummer, I was asked by Larry Page to write a song for another group that he was producing. He played the tape of my song and immediately asked me to sign a contract for it. I hadn't bothered to read the small print of the contract. Surely that was irrelevant. What mattered was that my song had been accepted by the publishers and I was a songwriter. All I knew and cared was that the song had my name as composer next to the title. I vaguely remember seeing for the payment of one penny and 50% to the composer-writer. That meant I was to receive 50% of every record and performance, whatever the figure was. Later that night, my mother looked at both me and the contract with suspicion, almost as if I had done something illegal to get it. In fact, the publisher's signature was already stamped on the bottom of the standard one-page agreement. Eddie Kastner probably didn't even know that I had written the song. The song was to be recorded by an all-girl trio called the Orchids and produced by Larry for Decca Records, who had previously turned down the Kinks, and so the fact that my song was recorded for that label added a little sugar to what would have been a bitter pill. There was actually no money involved yet. That would come later, when the record became a success. My work was done. All I had to do was turn up at the session and brood in the corner like the average moody young genius songwriter I was. In my dreams, I imagined the musicians looking over for a nod of approval from me at the end of the take. Then I expected everyone would applaud and carry me out of the studio to the strains of For He's a Jolly Good Fellow. I had no idea that the musicians would all be session men. Unlike my group, who would have willingly recorded for nothing, these musicians were professionals doing a session as part of a job. The realities of the situation were far from my mind. In my dream, the song had already reached number one and had been voted Song of the Year by the critics. Frank Sinatra had chosen it for his next film. What next? An Oscar nomination? A Nobel Prize, perhaps?
Hysterical.
No, I realize it was just a lousy little pop song, but in my imagination, it was the greatest piece of art yet created by man. Let's find out exactly what had Ray so excited. This track is called I've Got That Feeling. There you hear the Kinks version, essentially a demo of the song that Ray had written that he thought was going to lead to fame and fortune. I mentioned that it was recorded by a girl group called the Orchids. I can play a little bit of that. We just found it, so it might be fun just to hear the version that that Ray thought was going to catapult his song to fame. Or at least a bit of it anyway, that same song by the Orchids. I hope so. Just to get the point there. Kind of the same thing, just with like a little...
They are homely girls, aren't they?
Not very professional as far as their singing style either, but... All right then, back to Ray's story, if I may. We went into the Dave Clark tour a little underprepared and disorganized. The Kinks were being paid £250 a week, and that was like a steady job. But out of that, we had to pay commission of 40% to assorted managers and agents, as well as our own bed and breakfast, which meant that there was hardly any money left for us. But we were keen and ready for the big time, which we thought was just around the corner. So the fact that we were making no money didn't bother us. Although we traveled on the same coach as the other acts, it was every man for himself when we reached the theater. When we arrived in a town, the Stars, Dave Clark and the Hollies, were dropped off at their hotels. Then we drove to the theater to unload the gear. All the other bands had road managers on board to lift the equipment off the bus and assemble it, but the Kinks had neither the finances nor the space allocated on the bus for any extra bodies. So we hauled our own amps on stage and set up ourselves. After that came the task of finding the cheapest bed and breakfast to stay in. Once this was done, we rushed back to the theater just in time for the show. We thought that we had done enough at the opening concert at the Coventry Theater to earn some praise in the press, but we were to have a double disappointment the following week when not only did our record drop out of the charts, but an article in the New Musical Express by Richard the Beast Green gave us the worst review of the whole show. The only song that earned any praise at all was You Really Got Me. On the stage of the De Montfort Hall, Leicester, the following day, the tour manager, Malcolm Lester. Cook, was it Lester? Excuse me, thank you. Added to our shame when he announced in front of the whole touring company that the Kinks were to be moved to the opening spot in the show and that the Mojos, whose recording Everything's All Right was now entering the charts, were to go on after us. We had suddenly gone from being the blue-eyed boys to being the whipping boys. Everybody on the tour felt it their duty to advise and criticize, and the more they told us what a shambles we were, the worse we performed. Before the tour, we had wanted to put in some blues songs like Howlin' Wolf's Smokestack Lightning and Slim Harpo's Got Love If You Want It, but we were told that this was a pop music tour, and all the songs either had to be in the charts or at least covered by another chart-topping group. We had already started playing You Really Got Me, and even though nobody knew the song, it seemed to go down well. But opening the show meant that we would have to cut our act from 5 songs to 4, and so You Really Got Me was thrown out and replaced by something more familiar to the audience. Nobody believed in the song at all.
Mm-mm.
At first, we took our relegation to heart and played with our heads down. But after a few nights, Dave started to jump around again, and a few girls in the audience started to scream. I was still depressed and humiliated, and as a result, my raving was restricted to shaking my head and arms and shimmying on the spot. I refused to move my feet from the ground. I had decided that I was to be totally professional and do this tour just for the money, all £20 a week of it. Quaife was becoming more outrageously showbiz by the day. His thick stage makeup was never washed off after the show.
Yikes.
And the collar of his stage shirt became caked with Max Factor. Pete finally reached the conclusion that it was more expedient to stay in his stage gear all the time, eliminating the need to change at all. He had the ability to make it seem as though he was continually pursued by admiring fans. If number 42 in the charts was to be the pinnacle of our achievement, then Pete Quaife was going to make sure the world remembered him for it as long as possible. Even though Dave was still barely 17, he was fast becoming known as the resident raver of the tour, staying up later, getting drunk more, getting into trouble more, and sleeping less than anybody else on the tour. The Kinks may have been the least known and the worst act on stage, but we had affectionately been taken on as the tour mascots by some of the other bands. Halfway through the tour, Pye Records released the second single from our first recording session, You Still Want Me. The message came via Malcolm Cook that our management wanted to put the song, wanted us to put the song in the stage act, which we reluctantly did. We breathed a sigh of relief a few weeks later when the record was officially written off as a flop. Although it was a sweet enough pop song with a good beat, the only thing worse than its eventual failure was the possibility of it being such a big hit that we would be forced to perform it every night for the rest of our careers.
Oh, no.
Even so, we were disappointed that we had not got into the charts, and we had seen enough of the music business to know that unless we made a hit record, and soon, we would be on our first and last major package tour. Let's hear the song that qualifies as the Kinks' second released single, called You Still Want Me. Second single, and not good enough, boys.
And no success.
No cigar there. The Kinks were still considered the sloppiest group on the tour, and messages were reaching us that even our biggest supporter, Arthur Howes, was thinking of replacing us. Our act needed help. Enter Hal Carter. The Kinks had set up at the Bedford Granada, ready for the performance. I had stayed behind so that I could wash my hair in a sink backstage. It was almost impossible to get hot water backstage in those days, but the Bedford Granada was one of the better-equipped theaters on the circuit. I was just starting to wash the lather out of my hair when a voice, a hard Liverpoolian twang with a hint of an American drawl, floated across to me. "All the Kinks here." I remembered a line from an old John Wayne movie, "Who Wants to Know?" "Hal Carter, that's who. I've been sent by Arthur Howes to work on your stage act, which I understand is in desperate need of attention." Hal was slightly cross-eyed, which made a mockery of the look of inner turmoil and menace he was trying to project. I could sympathize to a certain extent, because his crossed eyes had exactly the same effect on his image as the gap in my two front teeth had on mine. It made us both look a little vulnerable and, to less sensitive people, stupid. Hal tore into me verbally without pity. "I wasn't aware you were in the group. I thought you were a roadie, the way you were washing your hair in the sink." His eyes squinted as if he were about to reach for a gun. His voice dropped to a whisper, the Scouse R's rolling through the veneer of acquired Americana. My eyes zoomed into close-up of his face as he spoke. You are one of the brothers, aren't you? Well, draw your hair. Let's get the group on stage and work this act. Hal made me smile and somehow gave me confidence. If our stage act was half as good as Hal's real-life performance, then the Kinks were assured of stardom, even if only in B-movies. After watching our act for the first time, Hal came silently into our dressing room. He walked up to us all individually and stared each of us out for a second, similar to the way a prizefighter stalks his opponent before a boxing match. Then he stood and watched as we packed up our few belongings. Avery stood behind Hal and mimicked him, striking a familiar moody pose. He pushed up the end of his nose with a finger and crossed his eyes.
Oh no.
The rest of us tried our best to carry on without sniggering. But eventually Dave burst out laughing. Hal's eyes grew larger and went slightly more cross-eyed as he spoke in a calm but rapid, contemptuous monotone. You are rubbish tonight, lads. I'm here to improve your act by the time we reach London, and if it has not improved significantly by then, you are off the tour and back on the street. So I want you all on stage tomorrow afternoon for a rehearsal as soon as you've loaded the equipment. During the next few days, Carter put us through a series of vigorous rehearsals. He told us where to stand, how to behave, and what to play, shouting out corrections to us from the auditorium while we ran through our songs. Quaife, stop posing! Ray, let's see some sign of life! Dave, let's see you rave on your own! Avery, oh, it doesn't matter, forget it.
Oh, no.
He suggested that we cut some of our blues songs and put in some conventional pop hits of the day. That song, You Really Got Me, is all right. Put it back in. Cut out Smokestack Lightning number. You're not doing yourselves or anybody any favors by playing that. Change this. Try that. And try not to cover your eyes with your hands every time the spotlight comes on your face. You're supposed to be professionals. It was decided that we needed to smarten ourselves up by purchasing some new stage clothes. Robert took us to Berman and Nathan, the theatrical costumiers. During the tour, we had started to get a reputation as Dickensian type characters. Avery was called Bill Sykes. Dave was the Artful Dodger. I was Smike from Nicholas Nickleby, and Quaife insisted on being Pip from Great Expectations, even though his manner suggested that he was more like Mr. Micawber. We tried on what we thought were clothes from the Victorian era, but Monty Berman explained that they were, in fact, hunting jackets. He matched the red hunting jackets with white frilly shirts from another period in history, put us in black riding trousers and Chelsea boots, and lo and behold, we looked like us. Our first concert with the new red hunting jackets was at the Gaumont Theatre in Bournemouth. We were standing behind the curtain ready to open the show as usual when Graham Nash and Alan Clark of the Hollies were seen staring at us from the wings. Graham came up to me and, after scrutinizing my new stage gear closely, announced that, in his opinion, our new gear was fab. Now you look like you're the Kinks. The new clothes were an instant hit, and although we were still the opening act, with two flop singles behind us, our spirits were high, and we were optimistic about our future. Here's a track that actually appeared on their debut album called I'm a Lover, Not a Fighter.
I'm a lover, not a fighter. Yes, I'm a lover.
lover, not a fighter, a song that appeared on the Kinks' debut album.
And they're built for speed.
Now, by the time the Dave Clark tour had finished, the Kinks had built quite a strong following around the country. And we started doing some small ballroom and club dates. Sometimes I took a girl who fancied the band, especially me, named Anita, on tour when we played out of town. She rode with me in the back of the van behind the equipment, where she huddled under a blanket and resumed my education in stagecraft. The day Rosie, Arthur, and Terry left to emigrate to Australia, I took Anita up to a northern sea resort where we were playing a gig that night. Just to refresh everybody's memory in case you missed the earlier shows, Rosie is Ray's much older sister who literally like raised him as a mother. Arthur was her husband and a big source of inspiration for Ray. Terry was their child who was one of his best friends, almost like a brother. I freaked out a little after the show. I had a few drinks too many, and as Anita and I were walking along the beach in the moonlight, I suddenly started screaming. A part of my family had left, possibly forever. Once the emotion started to come out, I found that it had snowballed into an uncontrollable frenzy. I blamed it on the moon, the drink, and my sister emigrating to Australia. Anita blamed it on the fact that my records had flopped, and that I was getting a bad break from society, and my overwhelming fear of failure, plus my complete and utter insecurity and lack of confidence in myself. After I had finished shouting abuse at the sea and the moon and anybody else who would listen, I collapsed in a heap on the sandy beach and wept like a pathetic child. Anita told me in no uncertain terms that if I was as unhappy with my lot from life as I said I was, I should emigrate to Australia with my sister. Then I could fester in my own bitterness over there instead of staying on to fight the so-called system with my music. One more track with a title that's somewhat relative to that part. It's called I Gotta Move. Somewhat obscure, great rocker there by the Kinks. Back to Ray's story then. I thought about what Anita had said and realized that my only chance to get even was to make a hit record. My desire for success was stronger and even more important than the music itself. I knew that I wanted to become successful and I hated myself for it. Our first single flopped. Our second single had received some attention, briefly, and then it vanished apart for a few copies brought by proud relatives. Cynical aficionados described Kinks fans as mourners at a wake. Our moment had gone before it had fully been. Pete Quaife, our bass guitarist, would probably start looking in the situations vacant section of the evening news for a commercial artist's job. Dave and I were fighting. Dave and McAvery had started fighting. The promoters up north came backstage after gigs and gave us advice on how to improve our act. Their speeches were almost identical. Now, lads, listen to what I say, and you could earn yourself some decent brass. Thale had a different solution, variations on a theme. Stick in a ballad. You're too loud. Turn up the vocal. Play softer. They all had good intentions, no doubt, but they were condescending to the point of vomit. My aim was to be so good that the buggers would be left speechless. But I was still a novice. They would say their bit and leave as they came, unwanted yet full of self-importance. Mine was the first generation not to be called up for national service. Some of the promoters thought we looked effeminate. Others were convinced we were pansies. Avery said that some of us probably were, especially with a name like the Kinks. Dave said that listening to those well-meaning know-alls reminded him of the teachers at school. Dave had particular cause to feel resentment as he had been expelled from school for making it with one of the girls who went to a convent near Hampstead Heath. His was a story of sad consequence. There was Dave, banging away behind a clump of bushes on Hampstead Heath during the lunch break, when up walked the headmaster, who, by some strange twist of mystic fate, had decided to go for his lunchtime constitutional on the Heath. I suppose Dave saw that headmaster in all authority figures, including the promoters' faces, when they hinted that we would never be as famous as Jerry and the Pacemakers or the Searchers. McAvey must have thought of the foreman of the build at the building site where he worked after leaving school. Quaife was the only one of us who didn't seem frustrated by the nightly lecture. Perhaps Pete agreed with what was said. For all we knew, he was probably going for a job interview the next time we were in London, or worse still, he might join another group. No criticisms, however, could match the dressing downs we received from Hal Carter, who had stayed on as our tour manager after the Dave Clark tour finished. When Hal lost his temper, his transatlantic drawl snapped back to his original Scouse accent, bawling a waste of time and last, which I later found out was Liverpudlian for the worst. Even after a relatively good gig, Hal stormed into the dressing room to bawl us out. You thought you were good tonight, I suppose. No, Hal, honest. No, you can't fool me. I definitely saw a smile on your face. One day you're all going to surprise me and rave together on cue. Ray was standing like a spastic, and Dave was the only one raving on his bloody own. At this point, Dave stood on a chair by the dressing room window, vodka in one hand, the other holding himself so he could aim while he urinated out the window.
Nice.
He slowly turned to Hal as he said, "That's because I'm a raver." Hal, despite his showbiz bravado, genuinely tried to turn the group into something. We had definite shortcomings, but if nothing else, Hal started to give us confidence in ourselves. Before he arrived to advise us, I had decided that Mick should attempt to play as loud and dynamically as Bobby Elliott of the Hollies. On some occasion, we got on stage early and I went out front while Avery slammed away on the drum kit. I shouted, "Louder! Louder!" Somebody tell this to me. Mick slammed the drums as hard as he could, but I was not satisfied. I was upset that we had been demoted to opening the Dave Clark tour, and I was taking my frustrations out on poor Avery, whose hands were often bleeding at the end of rehearsals from the sheer force of hitting the drums. As he walked away covered in sweat, I was grateful the snare drum had been the recipient of the violence and not my face. Avery had big hands and could throw a punch. At the same time, I knew I had a sound in my head and I was not hearing it on stage. I tried hard, too hard. Sometimes I was a little bit obsessed, I suppose. One more track from that era. This is called "I Gotta Go Now."
I've gotta go now, gotta go now. She's
Now, Ray putting himself pretty much up against the wall in all of these situations. As the story continues, we had recorded You Really Got Me on our original demo reel, but the song was not considered to be pop enough for a market that demanded the word love in every other line. But it was the only original song we had that could compete with all the cover songs we were playing. Anyway, I love to see the kids dance at Kinks gigs, and I wanted to write something that they would jump around to. Dave had more or less exclusively taken over the lead guitar playing, while I took most of the lead vocals and played rhythm. Dave's stabbing style made even a ballad seem rough when compared to more accomplished bands in the charts at the time. Eventually, during that summer, Pi Records relented and begrudgingly let us into the studio to make a record. Shal Talmy insisted that we use session drummer Bobby Graham. Even though Mick had been with the band for several months, Shal had decided that Graham would get the drum sound he wanted much quicker than Mick, and as we were paying for the studio ourselves, we didn't want to waste time. Graham was one of the busiest session drummers on the scene. He had been the ghost drummer on many pop hits. Mick would be on the session, but only playing tambourine. Hal Carter had eventually left after a disagreement with our management, and so we had been reunited with my brother-in-law, Brian. Even though Hal was no longer with the group, he popped into the studio before the session and gave me one more piece of advice. You know at the beginning of the song when you start singing? Well, I don't know whether you're singing to a girl or a bloke. I always thought you were a bit limp-wristed and suspect, but I never imagined you'd singing the song to a geezer. Even though I have had my suspicions about you and Quaife. So, put all my doubts to rest and start the song by singing to somebody. Jane, Carol, Sue, Bint, Tart, even just plain girl. Whatever you do, you have to make it personal. I took Hal's advice about personalizing the song, but decided against starting with Tart.
Smart move.
I opted for girl at the beginning of the opening line. Girl instead of yeah meant a lot to me, but no one in the studio seemed to even notice the difference. I knew as soon as I heard the playback at the end of the session that the recording wasn't right. There was echo on everything, and my voice sounded distorted. The curse of Malcolm Vaughn, played on my mother's radiogram, had finally come back to haunt us. I took the acetate to Larry Page and tried to explain how I thought the record could be improved, but he flatly refused to hear my argument. Then I played it to Robert in Grenville and got a similar response. At the time, Dave had a girlfriend called Linda who put my feelings into words when she said that it didn't make her want to drop her knickers.
Oh, no.
I tried to explain to Shell that I would probably never write another song like it and that this was our last opportunity to make a great record. But he also refused to listen. He said that the producer's word was final. I threatened to leave the band and never have anything to do with the music business again, but nobody took any notice. Hal Carter pointed out that after the two flop singles, we were lucky to even have the opportunity of making another record at all, let alone re-recording the thing. Grenville didn't really know what the fuss was about. In any event, he did not profess to be an expert in recording technology. Robert Wace broached the subject with Monty Pesky at Pi, but a cry of outrage greeted the suggestion. I feared that the debutante season would soon be underway, and Robert might be considering a return to the stage, and my temperamental outburst, along with You Really Got Me, would be forgotten after a few weeks. The next day, I found myself alone in Larry Page's office in Denmark Street. Larry looked at me from across his desk and, after a long pause, said that he might have a solution to our problem. Castner Music had not yet been given a mechanical license to Pi to release the record, and even though it was a long shot with the risk of possible legal action, it might be enough to make Pi put back the release date. That would give us time to re-record the song. Larry put the wheels in motion straight away. According to Grenville, Pi Records had threatened to throw us off the label when he had heard that we had not granted them mechanical rights, especially as that put us in breach of the watertight contract they had with us. Pi considered legal action at this point, but decided to not sue for damages, as there was no money to pay them with any in any event. The best solution would be to let us record the song as long as we paid for the session ourselves. We were booked on IBC Studios, which were located in a basement in Portland Place. The recording personnel were the same, but this time they knew that we wanted to make the record the way we played it live. Again, Bobby Graham played the drums and Mick was on tambourine. I played rhythm guitar. Dave played the lead. Arthur Greenslade was on piano. This enabled us to build a wall of sound which would be complete without having to do overdubs, which would have necessitated copying from one tape to another, losing a generation of sound quality. It also meant that we would not waste any valuable studio time. The studio personnel regarded the re-recording as an indulgence. There was a lot of clock watching, and even Bobby Graham, who was one of life's most supportive session men, glanced at his watch when I asked Shell if we could do another take. Shell slumped in his chair, looked down at me from the glass booth, gave a giant sigh down the intercom, and reluctantly agreed. I was being treated like a spoiled child and being allowed to have my way until the clock ticked over to the last second of the three-hour session. Then they could throw us back onto the street with all the other aspiring pop stars who would then go nowhere. This was take two, and it had to be right. If I had asked for another take, I'm convinced that Shell and the engineer would have left the building. When Dave played the opening chords, Bobby Graham forgot the complicated introduction he had planned and just thumped one beat on the snare drum with as much power as he could muster, as if to say, "Okay, wimp, take that." For the next 3 minutes, he was one of us. We managed to keep an R&B feel to it, even though we were making a pop record. Now it was Dave's solo. The moment had to be right. I shouted to him to give him encouragement and spoiled his concentration momentarily. He looked over at me with a dazed expression as if he had done something wrong. His mouth relaxed and his jaw opened. For a split second, he seemed to stop playing. I thought that I had blown it for all of us. But then Dave's eyes squinted as his face broke into that arrogant sideways smile that I learned to love and hate over the years. The little runt hadn't even heard me shout. We had just thought of looking at each other at the same crucial moment. He gritted his teeth and sneered at me before turning away to play his solo. After the backtrack was recorded, Robert came into the studio and paid the two session men their fee. I watched Bobby counting his money. It was one of those embarrassing and yet necessary moments in the life of a studio musician, the point where the artist finishes and the hired hand takes over. Arthur Greenslade was another old-time session musician, but even he showed some interest when they played the backing track over the studio speakers. Graham smiled and started picking up his kit so that he would be out of the way by the time we did the vocals. Then all I had to do was sing. I remembered the first day I had thumped out those chords on my parents' piano. I was as alone as I had been then. I thought about Hal telling me to communicate and how dreadful my vocal had sounded on the first recording. So I made a conscious effort to make my voice sound pure, and I sang the words as clearly as the music would allow. I suddenly remembered all those family sing-songs around the piano, with my dad getting drunk and my sisters dancing with their boyfriends. I pictured Renee watching them. Then time jumbled together, and I was performing on stage in front of an audience. Those thumping chords started playing down my headphones, and in the first row of my imaginary audience, I saw a girl. Every emotion I had was focused on that one image, and nobody could deny me this moment. I had invented myself and somebody to sing for. At last, I was happy with something I was doing. I was so elated that I started laughing when it was time for me to sing my first line. Gotta listen for that. Even this did not affect what was happening. I was like a gambler on a winning streak. I couldn't lose. As the song moved into the first key shift, it was though I felt completely alive for the first time. I wanted the song to go on forever. We'll end our show by playing that track right now.
Yeah, you really got me now. You got me so I can't sleep at night. side. Girl, you really got me now. You got me so high.